Good evening and welcome. Can everybody hear me? Oh, good. This space is declared for tonight, the New York Society Library. Isn't it beautiful? My name is Jeanette Sanger, and I'm a trustee of this great library, thrilled to be introducing our very distinguished trustee, Robert Caro. This event has been fully registered ever since we announced it. And now, with the addition of Brenda Wineapple, we have been flooded with even more requests. To get a seat here tonight has been like getting into Studio 54 used to be. Now I'll pick up my earrings. Well, I won't worry about it. I shouldn't wear big earrings anyway. Members of the library, I would like to encourage you to donate generously. Your membership fees covers less than half of the actual cost of the library. And look at the rewards. An amazing collection at the oldest library in the city, the oldest cultural institution in the city. Fabulous events like this, exhibitions, parties, classes. Tea is served every day. And if you arrive early enough, you might even get a cookie. I know that Robert Caro particularly admires Anthony Trollope, and we have an incredible collection of his work. Not only that, the books are requested frequently. We have a Tea and Trollope group that meets every month. Robert Caro will be having a conversation with Brenda Wineapple, the author of amazing books, including Ecstatic Nation, Confidence, Crisis, and Compromise, 1848 to 1877, named a Best Book of the Year by the New York Times, White Heat, The Friendship of Emily Dickinson and Thomas Wentworth Higginson, a finalist for the National Book Critics Circle Award, Hawthorne, A Life, winner of the Ambassador Award for Best Biography of the Year. Her numerous other honors include a Literature Award from the American Academy of Arts and Letters, two National Endowment Fellowships in the Humanities, and most recently, a National Endowment Public Scholars Award. We are very lucky she was able to come tonight, as her most recent book, The Impeachers, The Trial of Andrew Johnson and the Dream of a Just Nation, has put her front and center as an expert of our national debate on the possible impeachment of our president. She has been a constant and wise presence on the nation's airwaves. The Impeachers was named one of the 10 best books of the year by a New York Times critic, and named one of 100 notable books of 2019 by the New York Times Sunday Book Review. And today, George Stephanopoulos picked it as his favorite book of the year. And now let us welcome Brenda Wineapple. Robert Caro has won every major award you can imagine. In fact, it would be a very short introduction if I only listed the awards that he has not won, as I don't think there are any. For his biographies of Robert Moses and Lyndon Johnson, Robert Caro has twice won the Pulitzer Prize, twice won the National Book Award, three times won the National Book Critics Circle Award, and has also won virtually every other major literary honor, including the gold medal in biography from the American Academy of Arts and Letters, and the Francis Parkman Prize. In 2010, President Barack Obama awarded Caro the National Humanities Medal. Bob Caro graduated from Princeton, was later a Nieman Fellow at Harvard, and worked for 6 years as an investigative reporter for Newsday. He lives with his wife, the wonderful writer Ina Caro, in New York City, where he is at work on the fifth and final volume of The Years of Lyndon Johnson. Tonight, Brenda and Bob will have a conversation about Bob's book, and then we will open up for a Q&A. At the end, Mr. Caro will not be signing books. However, Brenda Wineapple will. And now, let us welcome Robert Caro.
Testing. Does this work? Yeah, good. Excellent.
And mine too?
No.
Is mine working?
Yeah. Okay. Well, I think it's a thrill to be here with my dear and esteemed friend, Bob Caro. particularly because of the new book. I mean, I'm sure you're all familiar with one of his marvelous books, and I hope you're familiar with the new book, because what Bob does in this book, and here I'm going to embarrass you a little bit before our conversation, always, you know, makes things go a little easier. But what Bob does in this new book called Working is that he really lifts the veil from the biographer's or the historian's process. And it's an unusual thing to do, because what Bob is doing in this particular book is giving us some insight in his methods of research, his methods of interviewing, his methods of organizing his research, and finally, and most importantly, at least to me, in the way he thinks about writing his wonderful books on Lyndon Johnson and, of course, on Robert Moses. And I think it's very exciting to be able to do that. I know I did some work on Hawthorne at one point, and what he did was he burned all his manuscripts. And one of the things that I find interesting in Bob's book here is that he actually gives us manuscript pages so that we can see really the writer at work. And it's a very humbling thing to do, and it speaks of a kind of humility. So really, I want to talk to you about, and I want to read some passages from the book, but first enough of me, let's hear from you. And one of the things that I wanted to talk about is the fact that you have a kind of a two-part process that I notice in the book. And one is that Bob is very concerned with finding information, but then it's not just finding, it's actually explaining information. And I want you to talk a little bit about the second part of the process. Once you have information, once you've gathered facts, how is it, or how do you think about what it is you want your reader to get from those facts?
With difficulty. Well, you try and, yes, that's a terrific question, actually. I've never been asked that question, and it's the heart of everything. You get all these facts, but then you want people to read them, and you want them to get from them what you got from them. So what I do, actually, is I sit, if you saw me before I start writing my book, you'd see me for several weeks sitting in front of a page that is often blank. I'm trying to outline everything, put into two or three paragraphs, really no more. Everything, what is this book really about? Because I found, you know, you learn, sometimes when you talk, you sound like you know what you're doing. You learn all these things as you go along. When I was doing The Power Broker, there was so much information, and I couldn't figure out a way to make a book out of it. There simply was too much information. And then, well, I'll tell you this anecdote. So Robert Moses had long since stopped speaking to me. I hadn't seen him for years. But I would go whenever he was speaking and sit in the audience. And I remember he was out at the World's Fair site. Mm. The World's Fair was over, and the Catholic Church had donated an exedra, which is a huge Roman, the Romans had these, a huge curved bench for reflection. And he was dedicating this, and he was talking about why weren't people more filled with gratitude for what he had done. And he had a line something like, someday we'll all sit on this bench and reflect on the ingratitude of people towards great men. And in front of him were all his engineers, and I could see them all as he said this. They're all nodding, yes, why doesn't people? And suddenly I thought of, that's the line to end the book with. Why weren't they grateful? And as soon as that is the last line of The Power Broker. And as soon as I thought of that, I thought, well, that's what the book's about. He did so much. Why weren't people grateful? Why isn't the city better than it is because of him? So the whole book fell into place. Mm-hmm. And ever since, for every book, to answer your question, I make myself try and boil it down so I can see the last line in the book.
Well, what's interesting about that is that when you make what in other people's hands less skilled, less talented, when you make what seems to be a digression, and it was interesting to you pulled back the curtain because they're not digressions. What Bob says in this book is that when he's outlining, and he has that outline, if I recall, you know, in front of him, that he looks up and he says, is this part of the story? So even when he's telling the story, say, in Master of the Senate of Richard Russell, it's a whole chapter on someone. You don't meet Johnson in that chapter, but you know that all of the items will be then part of the larger Johnson story. And it was so revelatory to hear how you did that in this book. Something else you've talked about a lot, you know, you talk about in this book in a very, very moving fashion, but and that is empathy and imagination. And when you're talking about Moses, I have a few questions about that, but while we're talking about Moses, there's a part early on where you talk about how you imagined Robert Moses, how you imagined him before you began to do research on him, and how that changed, and how your view of him changed, and that really made him so, I think, exciting to you as a subject, really. It's a wonderful passage where Bob, well, may I read it? Would you mind? it really tells you a lot about Bob's method, and then I'll shut up, but I have to share this with you because it's really so wonderful. I have it marked. Believe me, we're not going to be here forever looking. He says, this is Bob writing in a chapter called The City Shaper about his beginning to work on Moses. In my mind, I saw him now, staring down in the evenings on the Hudson waterfront, and I couldn't forget him. Sometimes in my imagination, I saw him from below, a tall, handsome, haughty figure in white, standing on the edge of a high cliff and gazing down on a vast wasteland with the eyes of a creator, determined to transform it into something beautiful and grand. Sometimes I saw him from behind, a tall, black silhouette against the setting sun, Robert Moses gazing down on Riverside Park lodged in my imagination, and in my imagination became entangled in a mystery. I had previously been aware only of the Robert Moses of the 50s and 60s, the ruthless highway builder who ran his roads straight through hapless neighborhoods, the Robert Moses of the Title I urban renewal scandals, some of the biggest and most sordid of the 20th century in New York. Scandals almost incredible, both for the colossal scale of their corruption. Personally money honest himself, Moses dispensed to the most powerful members of the city's ruling democratic machine what one insider called a king's ransom and legal fees, and for the heartbreaking callousness with which he evicted the tens of thousands of poor people in his way, whom, in words of one official, he hounded out like cattle. Now I saw something very different, the young Robert Moses, the dreamer and idealist. How had the one man become the other?
You asked terrific questions, because what Brenda just read was, that's right. When I started the book, I knew only the Robert Moses who had, in fact, this is sort of an incredible figure, but I tried to take the most conservative estimates I could so he couldn't possibly challenge them. He evicted 250,000 people for the expressways that he built in New York and another 250,000 people for the urban renewal sites. That's 500,000 people that this one man evicted from his homes for projects which really, in many cases, didn't help the city at all, and in some cases, made the city worse. So that's what I knew of him. So one of the things that happened was I finally got to talk to him. He was determined. He had stopped every there were no previous biographies of Robert Moses except a puff job done by a member of his staff, and he was determined to stop me, too, so he wouldn't talk to me. After about 2 years, he finally did agree to talk to me, and as soon as he started talking, you saw something very differently. I remember we were out in Oak Beach, which is beyond Jones Beach, And he was at that time trying to build a highway the length of Fire Island. The highway would actually have been wider than Fire Island in some portions. But he started, so I was listening to that, and he suddenly switched to Jones Beach, which we could see out the right side of the deck of this little modest cottage that he summered at. And he started to talk to me about how he had thought of Jones Beach. He was then a young man without much power. Al Smith had put him basically in charge of finding a place where poor people, the middle class, which were just getting, the 1920s, were just getting automobiles, and that they could have a bathing beach like the rich people had. And Moses couldn't figure out how to do it. No one had been able to find that. And that summer, he and his wife Mary and their two little girls rented a house in Babylon. And he rented what he called a putt-putt motorboat, which was a rowboat with a little motor on the back. And Mary, and he fell in love. He said, I remember how I fell in love with the whole Great South Bay. And he would take Mary would give him sandwiches every morning, and he'd head out and explore the bay. And his attention was caught by this low sandbar on the far side of the bay. And he would say, I remember when I went over there, the weeds were so thick you couldn't get the boat close to shore, so I'd have to jump out and roll up my pants and pull at the last 50 yards or so. He said, but when I stepped out on that beach, I suddenly realized there was nobody there. And I was standing on the cleanest, whitest stretch of sand I'd ever seen. And it went on for all these miles. And at that moment, I was only 23 miles from Times Square. If I could just figure out a way to get people out here, New York would have this bathing beach. And he said, that was it in an instant. That was how I thought of the Southern State Parkway and the Meadowbrook Parkway and Jones Beach. When he would talk about things that he had done, like Riverside Park and the West Side Highway, which is what he was looking at, you suddenly said, well, this is a genius of a man. Mm-hmm. You have to, if you want to be fair to him, you have to, think of, this is going on.
No, it's fine.
We think of genius like Picasso in front of a canvas, or we think of genius like Beethoven crossing out his notes and all. But you say, this is a new, different kind of genius. It's the genius of the city shaper. Mm-hmm. And if you want to be fair to him, you have to show that genius too.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's interesting, I'm listening to you talk and I'm thinking, it's interesting because later in the book, and you've said this, many of you probably heard Bob talk about, his books aren't about individuals per se, but they're about power, and they're about the wielding of power, the getting of power, the maintenance of power, what power means. And one of the things Bob says in the book is that power always reveals, and it's interesting because when you're talking, when you're seeing and imagining the young Moses, it's before he has power.
Yes.
When he has power, it's something else.
Yeah.
And that's interesting because it reminds me a little bit of Johnson, too. Wouldn't you say that there's a kind of way in which you see Johnson the same way?
Yeah. Well, I think power reveals,
when. Why don't you explain what you mean?
Brenda's such a great conversationalist, I always forget.
Yeah. No.
Well,
you can listen to us
as someone's rising to power, trying to get power, they have to often conceal what they really like, what they really want to do, because if people found out what they wanted to do, they might not give them power.
Mm-hmm.
But once they get power and they can do what they want to do, then you find out what it is they wanted to do. In the case of Johnson, very dramatically, after convincing Richard Russell and all the Southern senators and everybody else that he was a segregationist at heart for 20 years, he had done that without a slip-up for 20 years, suddenly he becomes president and says our first priority is to pass the Civil Rights Bill. Now he passes the Civil Rights Bill and the Voting Rights Bill. So.
It's interesting because another point Bob makes when he's talking about this in this particular chapter is that power is not something abstract out there. As you make the point that Power, when you cash a Social Security check or when you take a Metropolitan bus, right? I mean, that is the way power has affected people. Yes. One of the things that's also interesting then about what Bob reveals in terms of his method is that he's not just looking then at the powerful, like Moses or Johnson, after they get power, but it's not just them on the way up, but you also make a wonderful point about power also is important in terms of what it does to those without power, the powerless. You want to talk about that a little bit?
Well, sure.
Binding?
I can talk about a moment. You know, as I
just
say,
a little bit.
This all sounds like I know what I'm doing, but it is as you worked it out. And here's a moment where that worked out. Yeah. So now Moses has gotten up to building roads. You know, he built 627 miles of parkways and expressways. If you are driving on a road anywhere in New York or around New York that has the word expressway or parkway in it, you're driving on a road built by Robert Moses, with one exception, the FDR Drive. So I'm now up to this thing, this section, where he's ramming all these expressways across the city. And there are all these textbooks on urban planning, highway use, why roads get built where they're built. And they all mention human cost. I remember you kept reading, but nobody, I said to Ina, I'm not going to write this book without showing what human cost is. And we knew, actually, at this time that was going to be hard because we had been broke for a long time while we were doing The Power Broker. And by this time, I had stopped fooling myself about how much time things took. And I knew if I wanted to do that, I would have to take a neighborhood and show what the neighborhood was like before Robert Moses destroyed it with his highway. And to do that is not easy because you have to find, for one thing, in the interviewing, you have to find the people who lived there before. Now they're scattered all over the place. You have to track them down and go interview them. You have to read all the local newspapers from that neighborhood, try to get a picture of it. So I said to Einar, this is going to take 6 months. But when I did that, you suddenly saw this particular road, the Cross Bronx Expressway, and this 1 mile of it through East Tremont. Mm-hmm. You suddenly saw that not in abstract terms, but in the terms Brenda's talking about, in human terms, because I was into finding these couples who had lived in this very vibrant, close community where everybody knew everybody else, and all of a sudden they're scattered, and when I'm the way I do things, if I interview people, my rule is I always type up the interview before I go to bed that night because I want their facial expressions and everything to be clear in my mind so I can put it in with my notes. Mm-hmm. And I realized I was typing the same word over and over, and the word was lonely. Mm-hmm. And suddenly you said, you know, that's what power does to people.
Mm, terrible, really. Yeah. I mean, it's heartbreaking, and you recreate it even in this book, never mind, in the Moses book. No, I mean, it's really fascinating. But while you're talking about interviewing, just sort of change the topic slightly, because as I said, you talk about researching the sort of tirelessness, just listening to you when you go through all the newspapers and the books and then searching for the people, and then you talk here about going through Long Island and looking for farmers who have been displaced, and there are not, you don't have the names. It's not like they're in a phone book or anything like that. So there's all of that, but also I just want to talk about interviewing for a minute, because you are a wonderful interviewer. You really, really are. I feel sometimes I've been interviewed by you, and I figure, you have such kind of sympathy when you're talking with people. But one of the things that is so wonderful that you say about your techniques, and I'm not giving anything away because you write about it, is silence.
Yeah. Well, if you read my, I say, if you looked at my notebooks, you'd see written the over and over again, S-U, which means shut up. So, so as Brenda, as has just been revealed here today, I talk too much. But you learn, you know, if you ask a question and someone doesn't want to answer it, sometimes, often, the best thing to do is not say anything. Because people feel a need to fill a silence. Sometimes they'll start talking and telling you things they never would have told you in answer to a direct question. You know, in literature, I know Brenda knows this, there are two characters in books that probably a lot of you have read. One is John Le Carré's George Smiley. When he's interviewing someone and he wants to keep himself from talking, he takes off his glasses and he polishes them, he says, on the fat end of his tie. The other great interviewer is Maigret, Inspector Maigret in Simenon. What he does is he takes his pipe out of his mouth and taps it and starts cleaning it.
And you just sat there? And is that your technique, just to sit there? and pretend you're writing, but we really is shut up. that's rather wonderful in that sense, but it's a very hard thing to do, is to learn exactly how to do that, especially when a lot of subjects aren't willing to talk to you right away. It takes a certain amount of time to get them. But when you're talking about that and taking the notes, the next sort of topic, because we can't cover everything, I want to get to is, you mentioned Le Carré and you mentioned Simenon. And so I'm interested in what you read or what other kinds of books have influenced your writing, because your writing is so exceptional. You're not creating almanacs. You're creating portraits of people in their time, and then beyond their time, a country, you know, in a setting, really. So are there certain books, poems, novels that you go to for inspiration?
You ask, you know, you're so complimentary to me. Brenda, I think I don't want to answer any questions.
You just want to hear me talk.
She'll convince you I'm better than I am.
No, I read the book more than once.
Well, actually, Jeanette mentioned Trollope is because he understands that government and politics are driven by character. It's character that decides political decisions in the last, and he understands that, I thought, from the first time that I read him. Another thing that Trollope showed me is that if you write well enough, the world will find you. I know we've talked about this before. Trollope was actually he wrote in the 1860s and 70s. He was almost out of print for 75 years. Almost no one read him. I found him by this accident. Ina was doing research for me out in Independence, Missouri, at the Harry Truman Library. And out there, I asked David McCullough, who had done the Truman biographies, a friend of mine, where do you stay out there? He says, you don't stay in a motel, you stay in Mrs. Fletcher's boarding house, right?
Oh, God.
So Mrs. Fletcher's boarding house was a really old-fashioned boarding house. They didn't even have telephones in the room. So when I'd call Ina, Mrs. Fletcher would answer it was like a girl's dorm, you know. She'd answer the phone in the hall and call
Ina. 1930s movie.
Yeah, one night I called her. This is why my books are so long. One night I called, and she answered, and I obviously woken her up. She was very querulous. And I said, I'm sorry, Mrs. Fletcher. I must have gotten the time zones wrong. I thought it was only 6 o'clock out there. And it was only 6 o'clock
out there. That's great.
But it was the kind of boarding house where people left their books, you know, in the living room. And Ina ran out of things to read, and she picked up a book called The Prime Minister by Anthony Trollope. I had never read anything by Trollope. And she said, when I was speaking to her one night, she said, I'm reading the best political novel I've ever read. And she came back, and one night she fell asleep, and I got up to take the book out of her hands. And it was open to a cabinet scene. I said, this is the best political scene I've ever read.
Oh, interesting. While you're mentioning Ina, and I know you often do this, Ina is the one and only research assistant of yours, right?
Yes.
Ina,
Ina, stand up and take a bow. Yes, Ina is a great historian herself.
Right.
Her books are terrific. And she's the only person I've ever been able to trust to do research for.
Well, that's wonderful. You're lucky to have each other. But moving on.
Okay.
And you mentioned Trollope. But you know, one of the wonderful passages in Working is when you talk about, you remembered, I think from college, reading the Iliad and having your teacher talk about the Iliad and how that influenced you. And in terms of not just content, because when you talk about Trollope, you're not really going to him for style so much,
but
sort of the negotiations of character. But for the Iliad, you went for something else, didn't you?
Well, yeah, you asked questions I never answered. That's a terrific question. I don't know if I can explain. I got to think about explaining that. So I was working on The Power Broker, and I had an editor. My first editor was not encouraging. He said, nobody's going to read a book about Robert Moses. You know, I had the world's smallest contract. Ina and I used to kid around about that before we went broke, and then we didn't kid around
before
about
before you
it.
Stopped kidding.
Then when we stopped kidding.
Right.
And I said, so I have to do an introduction that shows the importance of him. How it's important to understand him, how you have to show the immensity of what he did. For example, that he built all these parkways and expressways. So how do you do that? So it's not good enough, I didn't think, to say he built 627 miles of expressways and parkways. I said, but how do you do it? I said, well, maybe I'll just list them. There's so many of them. There's the Southern State Parkway, the Northern State Parkway, the Van Wyck Expressway, the Major Deegan Expressway, the Crossbox Expressway. But that didn't really work. And then I remembered the Iliad, and I said, you know, what was it about the Iliad? All these nations come to besiege Troy. And I said, how does he do that? It's so unbelievably dramatic. He says he makes lists. He lists the various nations. He says the mighty Carpathians from so-and-so, and this, who tamed the horses. I said, I wonder if I could do that, and I wonder if I could do it in a rhythm that would tell people, catch people up in the names. And I remember this took a long time. You kept putting the names in a different order, the Bruckner Expressway, the Sharon. And I said, well, you know, what is it? What's a way of really hitting people with it? I said, well, I make a rhythm that builds and builds and builds, the Major Deegan Expressway. And then all of a sudden, in the end of it, I change the rhythm and put a period there and say, he built the West Side Highway and the Harlem River Drive. Mm-hmm. Two things that don't have the words expressway and parkway. So I did that. That's what I did.
It's a beautiful passage. It really is. And if we had more time, I would ask Bob to read it. Do you want to read it? No, he doesn't want to read it. Okay. But it is a wonderful passage, and one of the things that the passage reminds us of is that, you know, organizing is one thing, researching is another thing, interviewing is another thing. But if you don't have the writing, it really won't matter. And, you know, and the sort of sources for writing come from a whole myriad of places, and certainly they come from imagination and empathy, but also they come from just the sounds of words. Do you listen to music when you write?
Not while I write, no.
No, some people do in that sense. Yeah. Absolutely,
yes.
Some people do. I'd be remiss. I've been told that I have to leave some time for questions besides mine. I have so many, but you're tired of me. So we'll have some questions now. But one thing I have to warn you about in advance, please, no questions about Donald Trump.
I'll I'll let you call him.
Oh, okay. I guess I get to call on people. So you're right here, so I'm calling on you.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Yes, sir.
There are millions of people who come into New York, go out of New York, go across New York every day.
Yes.
The car worker, his solution was roads.
Yes.
With some, it worked in some ways and it hurt. What should he have done, or what should have been done to solve this issue of people needing to move around?
Well, that's such a good question. It takes a long time to explain that. If he shaped New York. Can you hear me? Okay. I'm sorry.
Could you
repeat his question?
They want you to repeat the question.
Oh, the question was: there's so much. There's so much traffic in New York. There's so much car traffic in New York. Robert Moses' solution was to build roads. What should he have done? Well, the whole question would be a different question because, to just take one example, when he was building roads out to Long Island, Long Island was largely, Queens was developed, but not eastern Queens. Very little development in Nassau County and almost none in Suffolk County. It was a land of potato farms. He's building in the 1950s the Long Island Expressway out there. Everyone is saying to him, it's not me saying it in harsh, don't build this road without making provision for a light rail line down here, because right now, otherwise, everybody who wants to use this road, who's going to move out to Long Island is going to and has to commute into New York, is going to have no choice but to commute by car or on the suburban railroads. I should say, the suburban railroads and the subways are in as bad a shape as they are today because with all his power, he systematically starved them for 40 years. The maintenance that they're trying to catch up to now is 40 years. But it's a difficult question. I'll just try to give you one example. So at that time, the land for the Long Island Expressway was so cheap that he could easily have built the six lanes of the expressways and left down the middle a 40-foot wide strip on which you could put light rail. All the urban planners were saying, and you could have, the land was so cheap, you could have huge parking lots every few miles at every station, so people who wanted to drive could drive into New York in the cars, but you didn't have to. You could park somewhere, build a light railroad. He refused. Then he was afraid that somebody, the right-of-way that he built, that the expressway is built on, is 200 feet wide. And the cost of it was, as I remember, $70 million. For 5% more, he could have added 40 additional feet of right-of-way because the land was so cheap then. He refused to do that. But he was a visionary, all right. He was afraid that someday when he was gone, someone would come along and build a light rail line there. So he deliberately built the footings under the expressway, the substructure of it, the foundations of it, so light that no light rail line can ever be built there. So you say, if you multiply this by like 30 examples or something, you would say the picture of people getting into New York, the whole urban transportation picture, would be different from the start. I've tried to oversimplify that, simplify it, and I oversimplify it. Yeah.
Hi.
Well, that was the great thing. Some of the things that... Oh, should I repeat the question? Oh, I'm sorry. So this the question is to talk about a chapter in the first volume, Lyndon Johnson, on this called The Sad Irons. It's about the women of the Hill Country. That's why, you know, sometimes you make it sound like writing these books is so hard. They're also great things. And Ina and I were living down there. We We were in an apartment in Austin, but I was driving out into the hill country where Lyndon Johnson grew up, and I said, you know, this is a whole different world. I don't know this world, but this is what formed Lyndon Johnson. We're going to have to learn it. And so we moved there for 3 years. It's a very isolated, remote area of the United States, and the story that leaped out at it was these women, because they didn't have electricity. Because they didn't have electricity, they had to haul up every bucket of water for their household by themselves, because the men were out in the fields working, and it was such a poor area. As soon as the kids got old enough to work, they had to work off the farm for cash. So the women were alone, and they carried the water on yokes like cattle, so they could carry two buckets at a time. So Monday was washing day, Tuesday was the ironing day, and they called it the sad irons because they had to stand all day next to stoves that they kept hot. The irons were slabs of iron and heavy. They were 4 or 5 pounds. And they call that the day of the sad irons. But you learned about all these things, and you said, I'm glad I got to tell these stories because now, or talk about this world, because now there's not one single person left who can talk about it, but at least they're in a book.
Right. Over in the corner?
Yes, sir.
Yeah. If you were examining power in a similar way today, and you were younger and had the time, and your books about Johnson and Moses had been written already, who might you pick?
Oh, the question was, who would I like to write another book about? Well, to tell you the truth, there's one more book that I'd really like to write. It's about Al Smith, who is the governor of New York, who's completely forgotten. You know, Oscar Handlin, the historian, said, Al Smith is the major American figure most forgotten to history. Franklin Roosevelt, when he was president, said to Francis Perkins one day, you know, Francis, 95% of everything we did in the New Deal, Al Smith did first in New York. He was a guy who had no education. He was a Tammany hack, a ruthless Tammany guy. He becomes the first Irish Catholic to be governor, a governor of any state, and he goes to the Tammany bosses and says, now you have to free me. I have to work for my people. It's a great story, and I've always wanted to do that book.
Yeah, because power reveals there, too,
oh,
right,
yeah.
In a whole different way.
I never thought of that.
Yeah.
That's a perfect
really
example.
Really interesting in that sense, yeah. Way in the back.
I didn't hear you. Why ruin this perfectly lovely?
I know. Can you tell us where you are? No, I'll answer. Way in the back. How's that?
Thank you. Yeah. Why don't you come a little far? Could you hear? Come a little forward. Come up a little. Yeah.
Hi.
Terrific question. Yeah.
How any public opinion can limit.
Well, that's a very good question. So Moses had been in power for, probably 40 years at that time. And the press in New York was really behind Robert Moses. The New York Times really printed anything he said as if it was fact. And he was destroying all these neighborhoods. I think I identified 21 different neighborhoods in New York that he destroyed with his expressways. But no one paid any attention to it. It was like nothing was, there was no human cost. And all of a sudden, he decided to pave over, I forget how many acres, it says like 4 acres of Central Park or something like that, as a big parking lot for the Tavern on the Green, which he was turning over to a guy who was really tied in with his inner circle, the Tavern on the Green operator. And all of a sudden, the mothers around the Tavern on the Green said they're taking, there had been a playground there before. There's a playground there today. If you want to know where this is, it's where the 67th Street playgrounds are. And they said, wait a minute, he's paving over playgrounds which are really needed in this area for a parking lot. And they, being West Side mothers, they wheeled their babies in front of the bulldozers to stop them. And all of a sudden, this was a photo opportunity, and all of a sudden, it was like people woke up and said, this is what he's been doing. And all of a sudden, just as you put it, ma'am, public opinion changed dramatically and very fast.
I think we have time for one more. Go ahead.
Sure. Oh.
Or two more. Three more.
By Moses on other cities.
I'm sorry?
The influence of Robert Moses.
On other cities. Robert.
Other cities. All throughout the States and in some ways around the world.
Around the world. In fact, do you want to know how around the world it is? The Chinese have bought the power broker. I couldn't quite understand why. Okay, and then I started hearing that it's taught in all the urban planning courses in China, because they're building all these cities, and they have to throw out the poor residents, the old residents, and build these huge highways across them. And who knew better how to evict people for these highways than Robert Moses? But you're right. I mean, New Orleans, all over the country. He devised this plan for New Orleans, you know, which they for a highway that cut off the city from the waterfront. The Boston Big Dig. Other cities would pay him immense amounts of money. He would to design things for their cities, but the way he really influenced it is he was the world's greatest talker. When Robert Moses started to talk, it was really something. And when Eisenhower passed the Interstate Highway Act in 1956, nobody had built these big roads across cities before. So they came to Robert Moses, the only one who had done that, to learn how to do it and how to handle the fact that you were displacing thousands of people. And he really taught them his method. And all these highway builders went back and implemented this method in their own cities.
Yeah,
we can take another couple
questions. No. There was someone back. Oh, okay. Go ahead. Sorry. I'm sorry to point.
I the story about the Lady Jane from the village and her argument with
him. Well, that's that Jane Jacobs, you know, that's when she really stopped him. You know, if Robert Moses had had his way, at the moment he was finally removed from power, he was about to build three expressways right across Manhattan Island, one across 125th Street, one across 34th Street. That would have been an 8-lane highway, 4 stories up in the air from across, and one that Jane, the one you were talking about, the lower Manhattan expressway, of course, what is now the beautiful, Ein district of Soho. And she was an activist with a real genius for organizing, who wrote a great book herself, The Death and Life of American Cities, and mobilized public opinion. But this was after the Tavern on the Green fight. Public opinion had started to turn against him already, and this solidified it, and she beat him. Mm, yeah.
Amazing. Great. Yes, Alex?
Alex.
The written word on paper is fast disappearing or disappeared. Yeah. You're left with emails for your next book. How are historians going to read every word if you talk about it in your writings? is your profession going to be obsolete, if not more difficult?
Well, it's certainly going to be more difficult because a lot is going to be hidden, you know, erased. But similar things have happened in the past.
The telephone.
Pardon me?
The telephone.
The telephone, the long-distance telephone, right. Exactly. You know, when Robert, I'll give you, Lyndon Johnson's elected to Congress in 1937. John Connolly, later the Treasury Secretary and Secretary of Navy, is his aide. Mm-hmm. And Connolly's job was to go to the 10 county seats in his congressional district, go to the courthouses, and write Lyndon Johnson a letter each week on what political things are happening there. This is the greatest source for historians. Yeah. It's like you were there, because Connolly was very good with the words himself. Then all of a sudden, long-distance telephone become common in 1941, and what you have instead is Lyndon Johnson, a telegram from Lyndon Johnson to John Connolly, call me tonight and give me a report. Yeah.
Right.
But this is the most serious thing that's happened so far.
Other questions? Aren't there any other questions about method?
I have one.
Okay, good.
Your books are so full of suspense and page turners. Did you ever want to write a novel, say, right after Princeton before you really got into the biography stuff?
Well, everyone wants to write a novel right out of Princeton.
Well, here's a question. Did you ever, and put it in your drawer, and is it waiting to be found?
Well, it's being written. Yes, yes, yeah.
About the physical aspect of, say there are two paragraphs out of the Johnson archive that you want to be able to refer to and quote, or you're going through to make notes, what's involved physically? How much can you do? How
in
much
a day?
Before you become exhausted?
Yeah. Could you all hear that question? So the question basically is, how do you handle researching in the Johnson Library where there's so much material? And
physically,
how you do it? Well, physically, you mean physically, how do you get the papers? Oh, I write.
Oh, do you write?
Notes? I used to take notes on my typewriter. You know, you're in the Johnson Library. You ask for boxes. You know, there are 40. The last time they counted, there were 45 million pieces of paper in that library. So you ask for the couple of boxes that you're concentrating on at the moment. And an archivist brings them up and puts them on a cart next to your desk. You take the box out. There are all these file folders. Generally, I look at every page, because that's what I was taught. So you just take them out in order. And I used to type notes. You do it so long, you almost know what you might want to quote one day. You know, so you type that whole thing out. Or if there's a document that you just summarize it yourself. I used to do that on a typewriter, but then they don't like me at the Johnson Library. So they don't particularly like me at the Johnson Library. And so they said my typewriter was disturbing the other researchers in the room. Although at the time that they said this to me, the only other researcher was Ina, who swore she didn't complain. So I take them on a computer now, but I still write my books on a typewriter.
Once you get all those notes, what do you do with them when you bring them home?
Well, if you looked in my office, you'd see file cabinet after file cabinet. Physically is a real problem. That's actually a terrific question. Physically, it's a real, the mass of stuff is a real problem because there are so many documents, particularly, let's say, on Vietnam, where you have a meeting, you know, in the cabinet room and everyone's giving a different opinion. You want to have the notes on the entire meeting, so you have them Xeroxed, you take the notes, so you'd see a really immense, a lot Well, just in my, I probably without, maybe there are, I don't know, maybe there are 15 or 17 five-drawer filing cabinets that are crammed with papers, you know. The thing is, you have to organize them, Nancy. You know, there's so much that one of the hardest jobs, no one's ever even asked me that question before, and it's the heart of everything. So I got this, and it took a long time to work this out. Where I'm indexed onto my outline, first I make an outline of the chapter, and then then I go through the files, the interview notes, the stuff in the document, things, and when I see something I want to put in that proves the point in the outline, for example, I put a red, let's say 107, you know, and then I write 107 in the outline. And I do it that way because I don't want to have to stop. If I'm trying to create a mood or a rhythm in the writing, I don't want to have to stop and look through files. I have to know where everything is. So that's really a big, that's really one of the biggest problems, that sheer physical thing, just as you put your finger on it. Yeah.
Same for you, Brenda.
Mm-hmm.
Yes,
yeah.
But
fortunately, I'm not working with material. Also, classified material that becomes declassified, doesn't it?
Oh, all
which
the time.
You know,
yes.
Yes. Because we're talking about recent history, basically.
Yes, there's a lot of that.
Yeah.
You ask for things to be, you know, a lot of stuff is declassified. You're entitled to ask for a review and then to appeal the review and then to appeal the appeal. And often that way, at the end, you get the piece of paper that you're looking for. But it's just added to this other tremendous pile of paper.
Thank you so
I'm Well, we can't bring them all back. But really, it's oh, it's magical. Yeah, and we love the card catalogs. And the lettering. Never get rid of them.
Those are sacred.
And then the linoleum, and the, it's an emotional experience.
Yeah.
Not very long. That's, well, we were in London, and do you know the London Library?
Yeah. I was just there.
Well, they expanded. I haven't been there. Yeah. Yeah. No, thank you so much.
Yeah, the oldest library, a continuing library school.